You're listening to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie, episode 66.
Welcome to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie. If you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or emergency medical professional who would like to improve your family relationships, your physical and mental health, and want to have success at work and at home, well, this show is for you. Welcome to the Get Balanced program. Let's get started.
Hey, folks, this is Dr. Donnie, and I am telling you I'm excited that the Get Balanced Podcast has an official sponsor, and I want to tell you a little bit about them. And it is FirstNet, built with the AT&T. And what I want to tell you about them is probably part of it is that many of you already know this, but for first responders and frontline workers, communication, as we know, is not a luxury, but it's a lifesaver. And that's why FirstNet, built with AT&T, was created. Now, the FirstNet mission is to make communication faster, safer, and more collaborative for first responders and other public safety personnel. FirstNet helps first responders and frontline workers connect when they are on and off duty. They get access to priority and preemption capabilities. This means they connect to the network first. In emergency situations, first responders move to the front of the line to access critical bandwidth they need to send and receive, whether it's voice, data, video, images, and text. Now, during an emergency, FirstNet is a critical connection between first responders to technology and also to each other, giving them access to information quickly and when every second counts. With FirstNet, first responders and frontline workers get a highly secure, reliable network with 24/7, 365 customer care and monitoring. Now, to get more information about FirstNet, go visit your local AT&T store or visit firstnet.com. Now, let me go in and introduce our guest for this week. Okay, my special guest today is a former special agent with the U.S. Department of State and also the CEO of the 100 Club of Arizona, Angela Harrell. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Now, I introduced you as a former special agent of the U.S. Department of State because I read a little bit about you, and you actually, if you would, take us back to that from, I think, is ASU as a graduate and going to work a little bit. And then when we're thinking of Department of State with what's going on in the world today and what has this past week, you were actually, I think, if I recall, you spent some time at some embassies. So maybe tell us a little bit about your work back in those days.
Sure, absolutely. I'm looking back, people kind of laugh because they're like, you're from where? And I'm actually from a tiny little farm town in rural Minnesota. So I know weather. We've talked about weather a little bit earlier when we started this call. But yeah. From there, I thought, you know, I'm done with the weather. Came to Arizona. I went to ASU, Arizona State University, where we didn't have to worry about weather. It was just hot. And graduated with a degree in justice studies and a business emphasis. And I really, really enjoyed it. But I had the opportunity to get this great internship. And that's what you always want, right? Graduating college, you want to make sure you've got some sort of work experience. And I was able to get an internship with the U.S. Department of State, and it is the Bureau of Diplomatic Security Services. And that really, really opened my eyes to, I don't know, what else is there in the world? Because this, all of a sudden, it's like you're looking at a global environment. You're not in a little farm. You're not in a big city of Phoenix, Tempe area. All of a sudden, you're now like thrust into this global environment. And it's fascinating because of the influx of other cultures and systems that are in place. But I started as an intern and ultimately applied to be a special agent with the department and was accepted after a very long, tedious process. There's the medical piece. I mean, because you have to be able to travel everywhere, all the time. I mean, I ultimately was able to do some wonderful things and do some executive protection on many levels, working with our former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and some other incredible people, the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
The late Nelson Mandela, some amazing people in that executive protection type role. However, we also worked, as you mentioned, with a lot of different embassies overseas. And that was that physical security protection liaison type efforts that we have in different respective countries throughout the world. And that job inherently took me, I had a few long-term stints overseas at different embassies, but ultimately took me to almost 45 countries. And once you've traveled to 45 countries, you have a real respect for home and what you consider home to be.
Yes.
And you soon realize that all the stuff you have really isn't that important. And it really is about those that you surround yourself with and how you make the most of every day. So I was doing that, like I said, for nearly a decade. Really, really enjoyed it. The introduction made me sound a little bit like a badass, but I think it's more poor man's jet set than anything else. But I did enjoy my time there, and it now feels like an eternity ago.
Yeah.
Compared to the evolution of, you know, where you think your life is going to take you and then where it actually does. And I was there, like I said, for nearly a decade and came back to Arizona in order to spend a little time with family ultimately. But the segue to that is when you start a career, let's say in law enforcement or public safety, you know, you're young, you're single, life's good, and you can work all you want. There's no demands, no pressures. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I met this person, right? So I met my husband, and that really slows you down. Okay. Because then you want to actually spend time with someone else.
Were you an agent at the time?
I was.
Were you?
So he was a police officer, a firefighter, and a paramedic. Okay. That wasn't three guys, just one guy with a lot of different uniforms, an adrenaline junkie, so to speak. And so now I needed to cater a little bit to his career, and he's trying to cater to mine. And as you know, just in your teachings and everything that you're all about, that work-life balance is very challenging.
Yes.
So then here you've got a new relationship. You're trying to nurture that a little bit. And then guess what? You're pregnant and you have a child. Man, if getting married doesn't slow you down a little bit, having a child will definitely help you hit the brakes. And then fast forward, ended up having a second child. And then it's like, whoa, how do you do all this? How do you create that balance? Yeah. And ultimately I took a leave of absence from the State Department, and I was actually assigned to Mexico at the time. And my husband was assigned to Arizona. So that was inherently a good thing because we were close enough where we could commute. I mean, our entire relationship, we had spent time apart. It was no big deal. We did the long distance thing. And most people who know me jokingly, I mean, I always say the key to a lasting relationship is time apart. it's good for your head. It's good for lots of things. It makes you appreciate each other when you do spend that time together. And of course, like I said, always just joking about it. But, you know, during that time I was back here in Arizona, like I said, Bruce, my husband was working as a police officer, a paramedic, and a firefighter in a couple different roles, but primarily with the Arizona Department of Public Safety, the DPS. So I know that you have state troopers there in Ohio. Well, guess what? We now have state troopers here in Arizona. They used to be officers, but now they're called state troopers.
Oh, yeah.
And he was working on the rescue helicopter. So they have several rescue helicopters here in Arizona. And that is a very elite function. Because again, they are going out to the most challenging situations where many people cannot even perform at the level that they do. So they do search and rescue. They do all sorts of cool stuff. I mean, they jump out of helicopters for a living and they love it. They love it. The men and women who work on that unit. They're awesome people. Well, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of risk in that type of role. And, you know, I didn't ever really worried too much. You know, I did think that there was a possibility that there was a helicopter crash, and it was the only thing I ever thought would happen. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I was wrong. And in the fall of 2008, I was home with the kiddos. I had just gotten home from a day at the office, and I was just doing the mom thing, you know, trying to get dinner ready, whatever, got dinner finished. And the kids were little, they're just, I mean, almost 3 and 5, 2 and 4, whatever, however you want to say that, but they're young. And my daughter is the older and my son is the youngest. And I was running upstairs. It was a beautiful fall day in Arizona, just beautiful. So we had the one of those big security screen doors, if you can imagine, right at the front of the home. And the nice thing about those is they lock from the inside and you can't really actually get out without a key. When you have little kids, that's great. I mean, fire, yeah, I understand fire hazard maybe a little bit, but you know, at least you can keep your kids under control.
Yes.
And Bruce was at work and it was very common for him to be gone for 24, 48 hours just because of the shift work that he did. We were always doing that tag team thing.
Yeah.
And that particular day he was gone. So whatever, I'm doing, like I said, finished dinner, grabbing the jammies at the top of the stairs. And my daughter says, "Mom, there's somebody at the door." And I was like, "Well, that's weird." And again, it's a beautiful fall day. So that's why the door is open, but the security screen door is still shut and closed. And they're kind of hard to see through if anybody has kind of had that experience here, at least in Arizona. So I come downstairs, pajamas in hand, no big deal. And I come around the corner and my daughter's kind of looking at me and I'm looking at the door and I see a gentleman wearing a flight suit. Now in the public safety world, that's not all that common, but that is what Bruce wore to work every day, was a flight suit. And I had talked to him a few hours earlier. He was asking me for directions on how to get to a FedEx store or a UPS store to pick up the opposite package and where is it? And I joked all the time. I'm like, he couldn't get himself out of a wet paper bag. However, in the air, he's really good with coordinates and all this kind of stuff and obviously well-trained.
Yeah.
But even though I had talked to him a few hours before, I didn't think much of skipping a few hours. I mean, you're working. It's no big mm-hmm. deal. And in the public safety world, again, you're used to being like, "Oh, I gotta go. I gotta call. End of story." I mean, that's just it. Just, I gotta go. And you don't stress about it. You don't worry, "Oh, they didn't hang up. They didn't say it." No, you don't think about that kind of stuff. You're like, "Okay, bye." Anyway, I approach the door and I see a gentleman in a flight suit. And as I get a little closer, I realize that there are several more gentlemen behind him. And none of those gentlemen are wearing a flight suit. They're all wearing the infamous smoky hat. Hmm. And I just walked up to the door and I said, "Well, this isn't good. This can't be good." And I never imagined in my wildest dreams that it would happen to our family.
Yeah.
So I let them in and they sat me down and they said, "There was an unfortunate accident today and Bruce was killed."
Hmm.
And I immediately, again, I mean, clearly I'm in shock on some level.
Yeah.
But I said to him, I said, "Well, how's the pilot?" "Well, pilot's fine."
You were thinking crash.
Yeah. That was the only thing I ever thought could happen.
Yeah.
I never imagined anything besides that. I never even worried. And unfortunately, he was doing a rescue of two lost and dehydrated stranded hikers on the side of a mountain in beautiful Sedona, Arizona. He'd done the same rescue or similar rescue 100 times. No big deal. No big deal to him because of the training. And same thing with the pilot. Just, you know, we had some out of town hikers who had gone off trail and were worried about running out of water and worried about, you know, the hours getting later in the day. And even though this was middle of the afternoon, it was like around 2:30 p.m. And when he had gone up, so they launched out of Flagstaff where he was based. Helicopter flew out there. They located the hikers and then they landed, but they were doing, I believe they call it a hot skid. So the rotor blades are spinning at their maximum speed because they can't actually stop and balance because they're off balance on the skid. Mm-hmm. So the pilot had landed kind of, like I said, in that hot skid type environment. And Bruce had jumped off the helicopter, again, wearing his helmet, wearing all the gear that's appropriate, and goes, gets the hikers. And just because of the position of the two individuals, he had loaded the male in first. But part of that practice is to, if you can imagine, you take one hand and you brace someone's shoulder, so to speak, and the other hand, you're actually going to put behind their head. You're going to put your palm on the back and then you're going to push down. So everybody kind of ducks and like kind of ducks down low and like approaches and tries to get into the helicopter that way. So he did that with the male, no problem, loaded him in, goes back for the female, starts that same thing. And she manages to get tangled into a cactus or whatever it was. There was something there, and she turned around and he's trying to help her, and he stood up. And when he stood up, he was struck by the helicopter rotor blade and fatally wounded. That is semi how they explained it to me, but it didn't matter because it was unimaginable. And unimaginable because if you've seen a helicopter before, and I'm a puzzle piece person, I have to have all the pieces in order for it to make sense. I want all the information, good, bad, and different, just give it to me. And I'm like, but how is that possible with the rotor blade being so high and even standing under it? There's no way it can hit you. But again, just because of the incline of the mountain and the position of which they were in, there just happened to be a smaller space that they were working in. So there I was with these two little kiddos running all over the house, wondering why the house is full of people. And I grabbed the kiddos and I sat down, what we now call crisscross applesauce, right? You sit down and I put them on my lap and I said, Daddy got a bad owie and he's not coming home. I mean, what else do you say to little kids?
Yeah.
It's okay for them to not have him home, because again, he would do that shift work. And that inherently was one of the beautiful things as we transition into this new normal that people always say going forward. And it took a couple of days, and I didn't even realize I had done this to my own kids, or at least to my daughter, who was the only one that could really comprehend what was going on. It took a couple of days, and she said, well, Mom, when is he going to come home? Well, and that's that permanency piece.
Yeah.
And that was even harder than telling her the first time.
Yeah.
Because now you have to explain it at a new level. But one thing I've been told, and I've learned over the years from a different woman, from a different widow, she said, kids are so incredibly resilient. And they will ask the question when they're ready for the answer. Don't give them more than they ask, because it will help them be able to process that. So I've done that. I've tried to do that over the years.
Yeah.
So, because you're not going to sit down with a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old and explain all the circumstances around it. You're not going to jump into the permanency and how this is going to change our whole lives. And no, as adults, that's what we do. We overthink everything, right?
Yes.
But kids just take those little pieces and they just process them as they can. So that's in a nutshell.
Thank you very much, Angela, for sharing the story of Bruce and you. And as a result of that visit, that was shortly after that, I think very shortly after that visit, was an introduction by the 100 Club of Arizona. Could you tell us a little bit about that, what that was like?
Absolutely. So what I think is the 100 Club of Arizona is such a fascinating organization in a couple of different capacities, but I didn't know who they were. Here I was, all this time in law enforcement myself, and my husband worked in law enforcement and fire and the whole medical piece. Despite that, we didn't even know who the 100 Club was. And it is a very uncomfortable place to be after a line of duty death, or obviously after any death, because you are now relying on those around you. You're trusting the individuals that are in your home. And my home just filled with people. And it became, okay, the next morning, 9 a.m., we're going to have a meeting. We're going to start planning. We're going to talk about what's going to happen over the course of the next week. And here I am just trusting them. I really don't know these people.
Yeah.
I mean, I know of them. I know that they were colleagues, but again, didn't work real close together, because now you're working with like executive staff versus, the air rescue unit. They don't overlap a lot,
yeah,
but they do in a small or in a limited capacity. So the next morning at 9 a.m., the representative or my liaison from the department showed up and we started planning. And they said, there's a few people here that want to come in and offer their condolences. And some people have different levels of support for you. And you just got to know that we've somewhat vetted them and you've got to know that you can trust them.
Mm. Yeah.
And in the fall of 2008, for those of us who were alive and somewhat thriving during that time, it was also the collapse of our economy.
Yes.
And many, if not all, were overextended in many capacities. You know, we had a rental house and we had our primary house. We had things we should never have had. I don't know why the banks were giving away money like they were, but they were.
Yeah.
And we were somewhat victims of that. Not victims. I mean, obviously we were just doing what was being done at the time, never imagining that I would have to be doing this alone. Anyway, so the 100 Club shows up during this first 9 a.m. meeting, again, less than 24 hours later, and the former executive director at the time sat across from me and said that we are an organization that supports public safety throughout the entire state. And we are here today to provide you some immediate financial relief so that you can focus on grieving and taking care of your kiddos and know that we are here for you for the long term. And she handed me a check for $15,000.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was such a huge relief. We didn't have a lot of cushion. We'll just leave it at that. We just didn't. So that was like, okay, I can take a deep breath now.
Yeah.
And I just never imagined there was so much good in a community. And you don't realize how much good exists until something tragic happens either to you or to your family or someone close to you. Because in the world of what bleeds leads, you know, on the news, I mean, all you hear about, and whether it's here in your local community or on a global scale, are all of the challenges.
Yeah.
You don't get to hear all the feel good, warm, fuzzy stories. You just hear about the challenges. So I realized during that time how many incredible people could be there to support you and to really lean on you and help you through what seems like an impossible time. So that meeting with the 100 Club was transformative on many levels for me personally. And I didn't know it at the time because I was really, really, really focused on our health benefits. People are like, what? Everybody becomes laser focused on certain things because when you have to shut down everything else in your life and you have to just focus on what's essential for that. At that time, I had a daredevil 2-year-old son who was just always defying gravity. That hasn't changed. Okay. And just always, I was very, very concerned about our health insurance. And I don't know why, but it was mostly because Bruce carried the insurance for our family, despite the fact that I was working and he was working. We just used his insurance. You know how it works. And just get choose, you know, whichever one makes the most sense.
Yeah.
Well, during those daily planning meetings at 9 a.m. every morning, you know, the first morning, I didn't think much of it. The second morning, I was like, okay, what about our benefits? What about our insurance? And they're like, oh, yeah, don't worry. Don't worry. You know, I'm sure you'll be taken care of. I'm like, okay, all right. And it's not that I didn't trust them. Again, I just had this daredevil kiddo, you know, who was a free flyer card to Phoenix Children's Hospital. And that's merely just to get x-rays to make sure we didn't break anything.
Yeah.
And that hasn't changed, like I said. But I continued to ask every morning. And then he was killed on a Monday. So on Friday morning, they brought somebody new into the fold. If there's a new person in the room, I always get nervous. So I asked the same question. I said, what about our benefits? And he told me, he said, yeah, I'm sorry. It's the end of the pay period.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, exactly. I about climbed over the table and I said, what do you mean it's the end of the pay period? Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, he's no longer an employee at the end of the pay period. So there are no more benefits effective today. We hadn't even had the funeral. It had been 5 days, roughly, since his accident. And I'm sitting there just in shock.
Wow. Yeah.
And one thing that I have always said, I never want another grieving family to ever have to go through, is to try to have to figure out what kind of health insurance can I get? You know, what can I do to make sure that my kids are okay? Because now it's just me and I can't grieve. I can't sleep. I now have to figure out healthcare.
Yeah.
That's not fair. And so anyway, it took, I became very passionate about it. And ultimately I was able to work with a few governmental liaisons here in Arizona and the legislature. And after about 2 years, we were able to get a law passed, now called Harrell's Law,
yeah,
which provides access, it's not paid for, but access to the department's insurance plan. And it would continue for the dependents of which were originally on the insurance policy.
Oh, well, congratulations and on that.
It is definitely one of the things I'm most proud of in my life, just because I know that it has a continuing effect for so many other people, too many, yes, but that's how it is. And it's such a simple thing to be able to treat that family as if they are an employee and allow them with the other 3,000 people in your department to participate in a plan,
mm-hmm,
just isolating them and making them do this all on their own, when what really is the cost of one more person when they're going to pay all their own premiums?
Right.
So
yeah,
that's what we did. So moving my energies, you know, just taking that energy or whatever it is that you have, or your purpose. And who knew that that would be my purpose? Because I didn't. It was like real low on my radar, but yeah, started working on those initiatives. But bringing it back to the 100 Club and meeting that representative, I just forever felt like I wanted to give back, that I needed to say thank you to the organization. Of course, you know, you write a note, you sure, call, say thank you, but it wasn't enough for me. I just wanted to figure out how to be involved. And I became an ambassador and I worked on some program development, and I just wanted to be part of it because I knew that I could help other families that may go through a similar situation.
Yeah.
So they let me volunteer. They let me help out a little bit here and there, but the reality was, you know, it was good. It wasn't enough. I actually started working for them in a true employee capacity for, I don't know, about 15 months or so. They brought me in and said, you know, we want you to learn everything about the organization. I said, great. And the former executive director at the time said, yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, moving on. And well, needless to say, she really wasn't ready to move on. I said, you know, why don't you call me when you're ready? Because I was commuting like an hour every day, one direction, two little kids, and traffic was a nightmare. And
oh yeah,
it's a nonprofit, so it's not like you're going to get rich working there. Okay. Yeah. Maybe if you buy a lottery ticket on the way there and on the way back, you increase your odds, but nonetheless, so I kind of took a little break, and then later, they called me in the very end of 2015 and said, Angela, would you come help run this organization? And I immediately said it would be the honor of my life.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I've been there now for, I guess, 5.5 years, and I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Now, for those that aren't familiar with the 100 Club of Arizona, and you mentioned the $15,000 check at the beginning, but could you talk a little bit about, I mean, you have a much further reach than that initial $15,000 payment.
That is so true. And knowing what I know now, I mean, the line of duty death piece is such a very small piece of what we do.
Yeah.
Even though it's what people know us for outwardly, that's what they know us the most for. But it starts with, yes, that line of duty death, but we also support line of duty injuries. And those injuries can be both physical and psychological. And they can be long lasting. We always hope that when we provide a benefit on an injury that maybe they're only out that 30 days. Okay. But there's the chance that they are out for years or are forced into a medical retirement, but we stay with them that entire time. So that financial benefit that we provide to them, it starts somewhere between $500 to $1,500 for the first month that they're out. And that is, you know, to the extreme, the $1,500 would be, you know, you're shot, stabbed, burned. I say that kind of frequently. It's like, okay, were they shot, stabbed, burned? Or was there something of that equivalent? And then we meet them the first time, generally in person. This last year obviously has been an exception, a little weird. But we meet them and we kind of stay on that journey with them. And we provide them additional financial support monthly up to $18,000 or until they're back on the job or unfortunately forced into a medical retirement. Yeah. So it's a beautiful thing on a couple of different capacities. Yes, it is financial support, but it's also a check-in. It's a check-in when they have been separated from their department to make sure that, you know, mentally they're doing okay, that they have the resources that they need. And as time goes on, that check-in becomes even more important because the distance from the department oftentimes increases as well. So it serves a dual purpose, and we're really honored to be able to do that. But so line of duty death, line of duty injury, but we also have a HEROES program. And our HEROES program is financial assistance in support of any type of life-altering situation. And that includes your spouse or dependents. And that, of course, would be something like a chronic illness. It could be terminal illness, of course. And then we also do support the loss of a child or a spouse to a public safety individual. And that's essential, you know, even especially, you know, in the realm of COVID, for example, you know, people lost family members, people were affected in a significant way. So we're honored to be able to do something to help holistically their family and not just the individual. So we have all of those things, but talking about family, we know how hard it is to be a public safety person in this environment. You don't go into that role, nonprofits, public safety, again, not gonna get rich doing it, but you have a passion and we believe that you should be able to work and be honored for your dedication to the community. And we do that through our scholarship program. So we offer scholarships to the children of all public safety, both serving and retired throughout the state. And this past year, we gave away almost $350,000 in scholarships to kiddos, which is such a beautiful thing. And, you know, the kids are thrilled and they earn it. I mean, it's academic, very academically based and scored, et cetera. And we actually do it through a third party because, you know, in this environment that we work, we often get to know a lot of the families and we want to make sure there's that arm's length opportunity. So giving away those scholarships is very impactful. Like I said, the parents appreciate it probably even more than the kids, but the kids earn it. There's no question. Yeah. Gosh. So, okay. I talked about line of duty death, the injuries, the HEROES program, our scholarships. But there's two more that we really do focus on. And one of which is our safety enhancement stipend program. And that is a place where agencies can come to apply for funds that will help purchase equipment that enhances their respective safety. Now, their respective safety is important. If it accidentally benefits the community as well, wonderful. However, we can't support everybody. So our idea is that we support first responders. So if a firefighter or a small rural agency or even a larger agency, they need new turnout gear or they need new ballistic helmets, for example. They need, you name it, could be a communication type device. They can apply to us for that funding. And that's what we do. And we give away a lot of money every year, in excess of $450,000. Actually, I think it's about $500,000 on an annual basis to buy equipment to make them safer.
Yes.
Again, the more things that we can do proactively, the less we need to do reactively. Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer in let's spend it now to make them safer, so we don't have to pay an injury benefit. So we don't have to meet their family after their unfortunate or untimely death. So I look at those couple different things and again, proactive type programs. And that brings us to the big finale, which I'm very proud of. And it's kind of the evolution of our organization. And it's actually how we met.
Yes.
And that is through our mental health and wellness initiatives that we offer under the umbrella of the 100 Club. And we have two apps, for example, out there. We have Bulletproof and Fireproof, respective, obviously, for both sides. And they are different. yes, they both dedicate their, their careers to the community, but they are very different entities. However, we're glad to support them both equally. But these two apps are an incredible resource mm-hmm. for all things. And it is not only to focus on mental health, but we have some assessments that they can take to determine, do they need assistance? Or is this something that maybe, actually, I'm okay? You name it. We can look at a couple different items under that. But it addresses topics such as, financial concerns, stress, anxiety, familial issues, relationship issues, a lot of things, and then coming back to, we also have webinars and trainings that we offer as part of our organization, but kind of encompassed in that mental health and wellness initiative that we have. And we believe firmly that if the more that we do in this arena, the less we have to do later. And if we can help them navigate their careers, of which they see and hear the unthinkable, things that you and I don't ever want to experience.
Yeah.
And I often tell people, this is the place where they can go. They can use our therapist finder. They can say, find a therapist near me. And the beauty is, and unfortunately I've had this happen, I will deliver, our phones have become our lifeline. Mm-hmm. And it's really sad. It's a blessing and a curse. But on your phone, you have access to anything you could ever want. You don't have to have the big world book encyclopedia, on the wall anymore. Yeah. You don't, it's much more personal. It's right in your hand. And we know that they feel safe using their device. It's a personal device. It's not a government issued, generally speaking, not a government issued computer. They don't have to go to a laptop. They don't have to worry about what people are seeing and that they're partaking in or whatever the case is. They can get therapy literally in the palm of their hand if they so choose. They don't have to worry about it being monitored and the department finding out that they're having a few bad days or they're depressed or they need to talk to somebody about whatever the situation is that they may have encountered. And I talk about the phone being such a personal thing. I have been with families right after a death and I meet them in, the worst moments in their lives. Mm-hmm. And it has evolved from spouses saying, where is their wedding ring? I just have to have their wedding ring, to where is their phone? I want to have their phone. Their phone has all of the special communication. It has all the photos. It's everything.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that it's now on par with potentially a ring.
I never thought about that before.
I never imagined it. Mm-mm. And that's one of those things that, I realized years ago was that we need to get something in their hand. We need to make it accessible. We need to make it safe and anonymous, confidential. We need it to be a place that is not tracked. We need it to be something that they'll actually engage in.
Yeah.
And it started, Bulletproof, Fireproof, it started as a website. Great. Wonderful. But again, okay, I'm going to remember that. We all say that every day. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's like a grocery store advertisement or special, I'm going to look that up when I get home. Okay.
Right.
Well, you're not in that same place. You're probably not going to remember what the website was or the QR code, whatever it is.
Angela, those are half of my pictures on my phone, are things that I want to remember.
Exactly. So they'll be like, all right, did he remember? And I laugh because you say that and you look at your phone, you're like, let's say, God forbid, something happens. Well, it's like, oh, he was going to go do this. I wonder if he did that. I wonder if he was able to take care of that. I wonder if he ever reached out for help.
Yeah.
And we just want to make the resources available to public safety. Mm-hmm. I mean, right at their fingertips.
And I would like to vouch for that, because as I do the workshops in conjunction with the 100 Club of Arizona, all the workshops that I do in Arizona, we go over the Bulletproof and Fireproof app at the beginning of the workshops. And many of the agencies have them, and the feedback that I get from them is wonderful. I mean, it truly is wonderful. What, because they love how it is, it's completely private. There's no tracking. It's completely anonymous, and they have all these different resources at their fingertips. So, it's going very, very well, and I know it's growing too. You know, from just being in the field.
It is growing. Well, yeah. And that's the beauty. And, you know, we actually used to think that we were somewhat leaders in the industry. And for the record, we were, right? We had this platform that was virtual, that was someplace that people could go. Now, that was right before, let me see, February 2020. We're like, okay, this is amazing. We're like, we've got this. And all of a sudden, the pandemic hits. And now everything in the world is virtual. But we are so thankful that as an organization, a small nonprofit organization, that we were able to put this into effect prior to all things being locked down in our society. Because yes. If we hadn't, we probably wouldn't have had that same level of capacity. But that is, again, how we met, how we've been able to work together, you and our organization, is simply that we were able to take all of these trainings, all of these offerings, all of these resources, and put these webinars in place and get the information out, despite the lockdown, in a safe environment, into their homes so that they can learn and make themselves better. They can work on their continuing education. They can work on their family, work, life, balance, whether it's spiritual or whether it's academic, you name it. Mm-hmm. All of those things are so incredibly important. And I look back and I'm thinking, gosh, all of the webinars, everything that we did, it was beautiful. But the thing that I think a lot of our, even our supporters don't completely understand is simply that during COVID-19, the pandemic, all of these things, our public safety members, our officers, our firefighters, they didn't get to lock down. Mm-mm. They didn't get to hole up in their homes and, you know, just work out, spend time with family. It just didn't work like that. It actually created a whole nother level of stress and concern and anxiety for them, because mm-hmm. they were forced to go out every day and interact with the public with this unknown pathogen out there that is affecting them, that they might be bringing home to their own family.
Big stressor right there.
Huge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's very little that they can do about it. And in the beginning, we were fortunate that, you know, local area hotels here were saying, if you are a frontline worker, you can stay with us at no cost. And they were allowing people to do that, because if there was an exposure, that way they didn't have to bring exposure home to their family. You know, that even applied to healthcare workers. So, you know, obviously we've seen how it's evolved, and now we know some of the impacts, and, you know, we know that we can now go to the grocery store. Not everybody needs to stock up on toilet paper that'll last 10 years. I mean, there's a lot of things that we've learned, right? Yeah. In the course of the last year and a half. But I always want to stress that they didn't get the opportunity. They didn't get the opportunity to lock down. They had to be in front of it and exposed to it every single day. And that put us in a unique place as a supporter, as those who stand behind those who wear the badge. We support them. We needed to make sure that we, again, increase their level of security and safety as much as we could, as somewhat of a bystander as their support system. And that was through webinars and training. Mm-hmm. That was through making sure that we could buy PPE, that they had the masks, that they had the gloves, that they had bleach. I mean, little things that, you know, we couldn't get. You and I just going into Costco, that made it really difficult. However, I know that, you know, we can use our resources to make sure that we have hand sanitizer and those kind of things that was so critically important in the very beginning and obviously has tapered off since.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, Angela, we're coming up on time here a little bit on the podcast. I want to get to a couple other things. I want to get your take.
Hey, folks, this concludes part one of two, the podcast with Angela Harold, CEO of the 100 Club of Arizona. Part two of this podcast will be coming up soon. Hey, if you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or EMS professional who enjoys this podcast and would like some help with your work-life balance, you need to check out my Get Balance program. Not sure if you are balanced or not? Join me over at DonnieHutchinson.com and take the quiz. Together, we are going to get you balanced.